So, what's it like to spend a career in security intelligence and or law enforcement and then go public about it? Hi, this is Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Russell, Canada. And you're listening to Canadian Intelligence, eh? Now, for the record, I'm not talking about myself. Yes, I've done a lot of media since I retired from the security service back in 2015, but it's a pretty rare thing in Canada. In down in the States, people who worked in law enforcement or for the CIA or NSA, they're a dime a dozen. Every radio station, TV station has their resident expert. Here in Canada, for the most part, the dialogue has been monopolized, I can use that word, mostly by academics, people who don't actually work at the coalface. I'm not saying that they don't know anything. I'm just saying it's a different perspective. People who actually did work, on investigations, stuff like that, are pretty rare beasts in this country. I made the decision to do so 6 years ago, and I'm still liking it. But I've decided to invite on the podcast a someone who's been doing it for a long time as well and does it very, very well. So I'm absolutely thrilled beyond belief to have on the podcast Chris Lewis, who was the commissioner of the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, and has been on TV more times than I can remember. And we're going to talk about this notion about what it's like to translate a career in law enforcement into one in which you're basically providing commentary and insight and perspectives for the average Canadian. Chris, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure to be here with you, Phil.
Now, you spent an awful lot of time in law enforcement. I was looking at your bio on the, reliable Wikipedia, and apparently you're from Sault Ste. Marie, good old Northern Ontario boy. Your first posting is was a detachment in Kapuskasing, if that's correct.
That's right, 1978.
We won't go back to those years, Chris. That was a long time ago. But when we talk about, first of all, from our listeners, the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, has been around for more than a century. Was actually created in response to some concerns about the mining sector up in Northern Ontario in the early part of the 20th century. You get miners and you get beer, put them together. Sometimes you get a bit of a, I don't know, a to-do going. But it's become it's one of two provinces in Canada that have a provincial police force. So, Chris, what was it about police that attracted you way back in 1978?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I originally wanted to be a geologist. I thought about policing as a kid. I read a lot. I was a voracious reader, everything from the Hardy Boys to whatever as a kid. And so investigating and being a police officer really interested me. But then I thought, oh, there's more to life. And, I may not be the type, and I'm young and footloose and fancy free. I did some things I thought would probably prevent me from getting in the police department. But anyway,
we won't have to go over those stories again, Chris.
No. but anyway, I applied. I took a year off between high school and university, and got sailing on the Great Lakes, working on a ship and still reading a lot. And I thought, no, I want to be a police officer. So I didn't go back to university full time, and which has always been a regret. But I applied to the OPP. I got hired at age 21 with a high school diploma, and that was it. And
wow.
And from the north, I wanted to serve in the north. And so I went to Kapuskasing, not having a clue what anything but frontline uniform policing might be, and maybe someday I might be a detective.
Interesting.
That was kind of my plan. Maybe be a corporal someday and be a detective. That was it. And here we are all these years later.
And lo and behold, you became the bloody commissioner at the end of your career.
It's amazing. I'll be the last commissioner to not have a university degree.
Right.
The current and my predecessor, or I should say my replacement, Vince Hawks, had a master's degree and,
yes,
and very accomplished and educated. That just wasn't me. I surrounded myself with guys like Vince Hawks, and they helped me survive and navigate some of the more difficult challenges like budgets and things I really was never good with. I had great people, and I listened to them, and they got me through. And so, yeah, who'd have thought? I mean, I took a lot of university courses over the years. I just never did finish degree, and I may still. Who knows? Depending on my health and other situations over the coming years. But interesting 36 years of my life for sure.
Well, it's something I often say too, Chris. I had a job where, in security intelligence for 32 years where I couldn't wait to get to work every morning because it was all so different, exciting. And for my listeners, Vince Hawks, I know Vince quite well. He's now with the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
He is, yes.
And so he's taken his retirement from the OPP commissioner onto that. Chris, I think for most people, when they think of the OPP, they think of, you know, Highway Patrol, which is what, you know, a large part of the mandate is. But there is a national security slash public safety face of the OPP, which kind of gets lost, I think, in the, you know, the shuffle with the RCMP and CSIS and things like that. Can you walk us through, from your perspective of your time with the OPP, how did you guys sort of see the national security slash public safety nexus?
Well, early in my career, like back in those days in Kapuskasing, the OPP didn't see any links to national security. I mean, terrorism really was unheard of other than Munich, the Munich Olympics, and the yep. terrorist attack there, which is small potatoes in comparison to what we've seen since, obviously. The only response from the OPP back then was to form a tactical team or a SWAT team, thinking that someday we might have to do something like that, respond. It wasn't about intelligence gathering or analysis. It wasn't about conducting investigations. It was just about maybe we have to respond. And then that course,
when the shit hits the, fan, you got to kind of be there.
For sure. Yeah. And you know, back then we thought kind of like a hostage situation of any kind, mm-hmm. but, you know, motivated by something other than criminal activity, you know, was kind of right. the thought process. So then over the years to follow, as time went on, working mostly with the RCMP, we got started getting more embroiled in investigations and intelligence gathering on that national security front. Now, obviously, the RCMP and, of course, with the evolution from the security service and the Mounties into CSIS, a lot of that changed. And it was always their priority as organized federal organizations. Ours was really to support them. But given that right. the OPP is the local police in, I don't know, 350 of Ontario's municipalities, you know, we're linked to the community. And so in addition to having all the provincial resources, surveillance teams and wiretaps and all the ability mm-hmm. to do all those things, conduct investigations, gather intelligence, et cetera, we're linked to the communities and linked to the people in the communities who may well have heard or seen or know something that would support those broader investigations.
There's no question that having the local contacts and local trust, I mean, that's what intelligence gathering is all about, right, is having relationships that you've basically managed and you've coddled over the years so that people are going to want to trust you to provide information. It's a great segue, Chris, into, you know, while you're at the OPP, of course, the anti-terrorism section was created. This, of course, was in the wake of 9/11. For my listeners' reminder, I did spend some time with the anti-terrorism section when I retired from CSIS in 2015. Can you walk me through, from the OPP's perspective, what it was like? I mean, you know, what was sort of, I mean, yeah, 9/11 just happened. I think it was probably a desire to kind of get into that kind of game in a more formal fashion. Was that a difficult process to create PATS, the Provincial Anti-Terrorism Section?
I don't think it was a difficult process. I mean, as things like terrorism have emerged, or cybercrime or child exploitation, some of those things are emerging issues that we had to respond to as a police, provincial police department and municipal police department. And so we did. Finding the resources, finding the funding always mm-hmm. becomes the challenge, because right. you have to take away from something in order to fund exactly. whatever this is. But at the time, we went to government in post 9/11. We went to government with a variety of proposals to enhance our tactical operations, create our provincial, I think back then we called it provincial emergency response teams. We started getting into a chemical and radiological and biological wow. attacks, thinking of being able to respond to all those things. But we also got embroiled in a number of investigations. You'll recall AO Canada, yep. a huge, mm-hmm. huge operation. And we put some senior officers and a pile of investigators and surveillance teams and others into that, all in the wake of 9/11. And then, of course, Toronto 18 and other things followed. Yes. So we enhanced, we added resources, and developed an in-house expertise, always working, though, in concert with municipal and, obviously, mm-hmm. our federal partners. More often in support of them, but, you know, at times we started investigations that got to a certain point, and we got involved with the people whose mandate that truly is, and on that right. national security level.
But I would imagine that one of the advantages the OPP had, as opposed to where I was at CSIS, of course, is that CSIS doesn't collect evidence, it collects intelligence. So we don't use the same evidentiary standard that law enforcement does. As a law enforcement agency, the investigations that you would have been involved in from the national security perspective, when you went about doing it, you guys already were doing things to an evidentiary level, which meant that any information that you gathered in the course of your investigations, which could be handed off, let's say, to the RCMP for potential further prosecution, were already in the format where it could be used by the other police force, correct?
Absolutely. It's a good point, actually, and a great observation. I've worked a little bit with NATO doing some training overseas at their college in Stavanger, Norway, and dealing with military intelligence people from the civilian policing perspective and trying to educate them that it's a little different. We need evidence that we can put before a court that has to have been gathered in conjunction with the requirements of the Constitution and criminal law and on and on. And so that's a little different mindset. But you're right. We did that in organized crime investigations and other major crime investigations where we're looking to gather stuff that we could put together before a court in the legal way, having not violated people's rights or anything like that. Just a different different methodology than the national security stuff, which has linkages obviously to that, but you know, a little different role for sure.
Because of course, you know, and there's a, in fact, there's a case that's unfolding now in Ottawa of the man called Ausul Peshdari, with whom I'm very, very familiar, who has been arrested for the second time on terrorism charges. He was acquitted the first time. And the defense is going after the fact that one of the RCMP agents was apparently at one point a CSIS source. And they're saying, well, in order to defend my client properly, I need access to what CSIS knew about this individual. And CSIS saying, no, we're not part of this. We're not part of the court case. So the judge, I believe, is ruling on this particular issue. And if the judge decides that CSIS information is disclosable in court, that's a really, really bad day for the security service, because that's not their mandate. And it may open a whole kettle of fish that I think is going to put us in a very bad place here in Canada. So you guys definitely weren't... you weren't worried about that because it was part and parcel of your job anyway as law enforcement officers.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of conflict's come up for us in the past when CSIS, for example, notified us of something bad that might happen in a community. It was clearly criminal. They got onto it through national security sources and some you know, wiretap stuff that they can do under certain circumstances under their mandate. And so it became a bit of a rub in terms of how do we act on this based on the fact that here's how we're alerted. And so not wanting to ruin CSIS's other investigations, we eventually walked away from it, ended up kind of telling somebody, we know you got a gun and we know you're going to do something bad. We just can't tell you how we know. We can't take you to court because of the links to CSIS. But it all worked out.
Yeah, it's very much, I think, a delicate dance. And you know, there are mechanisms for CSIS to share with the RCMP, but it's something that I think is constantly, there's a bit of tension there. And I understand that. And
for sure. More so, I think, in the beginning, Phil, because it was, you know, I think police agencies, you know, there's two things police hate: change and the way things are. And back when CSIS first formed, it was, who are these guys? They're, you know, they're secret spies. And it wasn't because CSIS people had done or said anything. I think it was kind of that change perspective from policing. We can't trust them. They won't tell us what we need to know. They always try to tell us what they could, you know, within the legislation, et cetera. So I think that's way behind us now. And having somebody like a CSIS guy sitting at CISO in Ontario when I was there, we brought in the first CSIS guy at the time, whose name was Marty. And and he, you know, he helped bridge the gap. You know, in a big way on the Ontario perspective anyway, to try and make sure we're working together as much as we possibly could, knowing the limitations.
So for listeners around, this is called Criminal Intelligence Services Ontario. Every province in Canada has a Criminal Intelligence Service. It's a federal body, but they have provincial branches. And it's a way to, as Chris said, you know, you bring all the people to the table. It's almost like the INSETs, the Integrated National Security Enforcement Teams that the RCMP has. You try to bring your partners from across the country who have a bit of piece of the puzzle, so that at the end of the day, you get the entire picture kind of thing.
Yep. And that was on the organized crime front. But then of course, CSIS started getting involved in AO Canada and some of those big national security operations as well, because we had the intelligence gathering mechanisms in place focused on organized crime. So it was easy to adapt to the bigger picture. But Ontario CISO was actually the first in Canada before the federal body CISC started. You know, it's a real good model for working together, joint forces operations, bigger than police, other government agencies, including CSIS, you know, natural resources, customs, and all these folks all together trying to do the right thing. That doesn't get seen by the public a lot, but the public should know that it happens, and it's all in their best interest that it does.
I would think that Canadians don't care how the soup gets made. they just hope that in the end of the day, the organizations that are responsible for public safety, national security, are cooperating, are sharing information, you know, to stop bad things from happening, right?
And for sure,
you know, the way of actually creating this, of course, falls to the organizations themselves, and it's a bit of a tussle here and there. But I can't agree with you more, Chris. I think the model is what it should be. So you did your career. You left, I believe, in 2014.
I did.
As the commissioner of the OPP. And rather than just sitting in your lazy boy, I don't know, watching darts or billiards or something, you decided that you were going to go into a bit of a public career. And, you know, I guess I've seen you many, many times on national television, primarily on CTV. What was it that led you to think that, hey, I want to go from being a cold-faced kind of cop running the OPP to one where I want to have a conversation with the media and try to give Canadians a bit of insight as to what all this stuff, what it all means at the end of the day?
Well, it's kind of an interesting transition for me. I mean, I had the contract with Bell Media / CTV in place on my way out the door. Like I had already put that in place. Yeah. And I put 36 years in, Phil. I was tired. I had some health issues on the go. So I really didn't want to work 70, 80 hour weeks anymore. Although I loved it, I really wasn't up to it anymore in my view. And I always enjoyed the media side of things. And I enjoyed actually trying to give the public more than we traditionally did. You know, from a policing perspective, often we didn't tell the public as much as we could, hiding behind different protections, when in reality, sometimes who cared? We could easily tell the public. But anyway, so, and I enjoyed that. And I had a thing within CTV on CP24. I had a monthly show when I was commissioner where I was interviewed about live about policing issues. So that was kind of a transition for me. And they wanted to call me to be called an expert. I refused to be called an expert. I said, I'm not an expert in anything. I know a lot of stuff, little bits and pieces about a pile of things, but I'm not an expert in any of them. And that was one of the things that drove me too, because I saw the so-called experts on television. And quite frankly, knowing some of the people, I thought, oh, this person's a former Mountie and he's an ex-policing expert. I thought, yeah, he's a good guy and he knows a lot about fraud because he investigated it for 30 years, but he was never face-to-face with a guy with a gun, never worked on a homicide, never worked on a national security file. And so good guy, but expert, you know, I struggled with that. And not being an expert either, I wanted to at least try to put some credibility behind some stories and really give an honest opinion of the public. Here's what's really going on out there, folks. Don't run and hide just because there's a terrorist attack in Alberta. Doesn't mean we have to live in our basements in Ottawa, you know, and really trying to put it in simpler terms. And so that was what drove me. And it's only a very part-time gig. I wrote a book. I do a lot of public speaking. I just do a little bit of a lot of things and I enjoy them all very much.
Gee, you sound a lot like my so-called retirement. As my kids tell me on a regular basis, Chris, they said, you know, Dad, we love you very much, but you clearly suck at retirement. So
the best job I never had, retirement.
Exactly.
But, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, when I get get calls on terrorist attacks around the world, and more how would Canada be involved and stuff like that, I always make sure that I, you know, at times they want to know, is Billy Bob from ISIS associated to Johnny, whatever, I say, call Phil Gursky. You know, that's just not me. I know how the police departments would be responding from a public safety perspective and what the cops would be thinking and some of the linkages between agencies, but not ideologies and all. It's just not who I am. But I think that, you know, there's a time and a place for all those different types of expertise. The public needs that big picture from guys like you as to what is this all about? Why did they do these things to me? How would the police respond? And then between us, what would be going on behind the scenes in terms of the investigation, and intelligence gathering, et cetera. I enjoy it very much. I love it. I do it for free. I don't want them to tell them that, though.
your secret's safe with me. And just for the record, I didn't tell Chris to promote me, by the way.
No, you did not. Absolutely.
It is a lot of fun. I'm with you. It's enjoyable to try and get a message out there. And I also want to commend you very, very highly for doing what I do, and that's to run away from the term expert. Because as I said many times, when everyone's an expert, no one's an expert. And I'm with you. I look at some of the faces out there, and they may be very fine people. But when I look at their backgrounds and say, okay, you're commenting on this, and based on what I know, you never worked that. And so unless you've done something in the meantime to become specialized, I'm not sure where your knowledge is coming from. I know I get an awful lot of calls from media saying, you know, there's been a cyber attack. Can you come on? I said, look, I can't spell cyber. I don't know. And it starts with an S, doesn't it? I don't know anything about it. And if you have me on TV or radio or whatever, I'm going to look like a complete and utter idiot as soon as my mouth opens on cyber. So no, I can recommend people that you might want to talk to, but I'm not the guy to do that. So in that vein then, Chris, do you think that we in Canada, generally speaking, when it comes to national security and public safety stories that appear on mass media, are we well served in that regard? If you know as well as I do, Chris, I mean, the media are just looking for a warm pulse,
yeah,
a warm body to come on and spend 3 to 4 minutes and talk about what's happening. They don't do necessarily the background checks to see that this person has the specialization or expertise that he or she claims to. I don't want you to name names or anything, but just an overall general consensus on this. And you kind of said that obviously we need different voices at different times. Are we doing well here in Canada when it comes to the public's access to those who really know what they're talking about, or we're doing a pretty lousy job?
I think it's somewhere in between. I think on some things, the public is very well served. I'm not trying to blow smoke up your bum, but guys like you provide that. But then you'll see somebody that retired as a sergeant in training in Depot, or the RCMP or whoever, and no disrespect to them. They may well be experts in a specific field, but that doesn't make them experts in all this other stuff. And
right.
So,
exactly.
And that concerns me at times. At the same time, I get concerned that in some cases, the real experts are the people that are working on the cases, and sometimes they just can't talk and they don't want to hurt an investigation or a trial. And I get all that. But there's other times that, you know, it's pretty simple that the police could say more than they are.
Yes.
I think Nova Scotia is a good example of that. I mean, there was just so much finger pointing at the RCMP, a lot of it very unfair, I believe. But it got to the point where nobody was hearing anything because, the wagons get circled and it's a lot of protectionism and not being critical of the RCMP. They lost a member and a lot of bad stuff was going on. But sometimes I think, we really have to, we being police, and of course I'm not one anymore, but really need to say everything we can without hurting the case. And yeah, we might get sued because we said it, but too bad, because the public really needs some reassurance that things are under control, and we don't always get that. So they turn to people like you and I.
Yeah.
We do our best, but they don't always turn to people that necessarily know about X, Y, or Z. It's more general experience.
Well, and as two old retired guys, right, we don't have access to the current files, which means that we can't comment specifically on what's happening. And I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I've been a big proponent, even my organization. I mean, you think police are reluctant to speak to work for the security service, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. And, I feel for them. But years ago, we had a ongoing investigation. A guy killed his wife and he lit his house on fire in Northern Ontario. A fire department was there, a chopper, tactical teams had the house surrounded. And media said to the local police, "What can you tell us?" "Nothing. No comment." "Well, what's going on?" "Is it a threat to public safety?" "No comment."
Yeah.
So the reporter, an old reporter, called me and he said, "You know what? We're going to find out something and we're going to put it in the paper because we're going to ask a neighbor and they're going to tell us stuff that maybe isn't true. It's going to hurt your case more than if you spoke up and said, hey, we had to blah, 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 blah." So going from a tell nothing until you're forced to give them enough to make them go away to an environment where you give them everything you legally possibly can without hurting a case or jeopardizing somebody's privacy, and then explain those other things as to why you can't tell, in a way that the public actually trusts the person at the mic, more so like they might trust you or I versus some poor inspector who's standing there who said, "I can't tell you that," so it's tough for sure.
No, exactly. And there's the old phrase, right, that nature abhors a vacuum. And I think that, when those in the know are reluctant, somewhat understandably, for the reasons you cited, you don't want to jeopardize a case,
no.
whether it's an intelligence case or a law enforcement case. But there's so much that you can actually disclose that is not jeopardizing. But I think it's the knee-jerk reaction is no comment,
yeah.
because there are those that use the old slippery slope argument. What if I say this, they're going to ask another question. Well, at that point you say, look, I've told you what I can. You can ask a million more questions. I'm not going to give you specifics to what you're asking because I can't jeopardize the investigation. But here's what I can tell you up to this point. I think we'd be much better served. I think if that were the best practice going forward, whether it's for CSIS, the RCMP, OPP, or whatever law enforcement.
Absolutely, Phil. I couldn't agree more. And social media has exasperated all of that because when I first started working for CTV, you know, and I'm not because I work for them. I'm just a contractor, but. So I'm not trying to defend them, but the reporters I dealt with weren't looking for dirt. They were looking for what really happened. What, you know, who can we turn to?
Just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah. And it wasn't fake media stuff at all. And they would verify things and have, you know, so many sources before they put something out. Well, now they're under huge pressure because social media is already saying a bunch of stuff that isn't true. And generally, when they call me, well, apparently there's 20 dead. I said, there might not be any dead. We don't know yet. It's going to take a day till we even have any idea how many are really dead. And it turns out, a day later, two are dead and three were hurt. Yeah. Where did 20 come from? But that's forced the media to be pushing to get stuff out quicker to try and stay ahead of that social media curve. And that's hurt the media. They know it. I'm not being critical of them. It's just a different world now. And so
I think you're right.
It puts more pressure on the so-called experts to get out there and say something true. And that at times will be serving members, not necessarily old retired guys like you and I.
Well, it's funny you raise that, Chris, because of course the Alec Manassian decision, which just came down today, and it turned out that I'm actually going to be talking about this tonight when I go live. Manassian was probably not an incel. He made it up to make himself look big. And of course, that was the dominant discourse in the aftermath of the attack. Oh, you know, Alec Manassian was this diehard incel. He was launching a rebellion. He targeted women. Well, he didn't. He targeted all kinds of people. But that became the collected wisdom. And then once social media got a hold of it, it became, that was the narrative, that this was a violent incel attack. Incels are potential terrorists. We need to get the security forces prioritizing incel investigations. I pushed back. I said, first of all, no, it's not terrorism. At worst, it's mass murder or violent misogyny. And if you want CSIS to start investigating this, well, as you said earlier, where the hell are the resources going to come from?
Yeah.
And where are you going to take them from? Other important counter-espionage files, foreign interference files, other terrorism investigations? So, getting ahead of the social media curve with facts and reputable people to comment on, I think is an absolute must.
For sure. And, you know, that, and that's a good example, really. There's a case where people want to call it terrorism. They want to put this name on it. Put it in a box. It's terrorism. Why are we afraid to call it terrorism? That's what it is. Yeah. Well, you know, and you and I know what the definition is. And why are we always wanting to say this murder of three people was a terrorist attack?
I know.
To do with religion or politics or just, you know, whatever the case may be. And that's a good example of that. And so, you know, when you look at the Mounties, ever since the Ottawa attack, at the Parliament buildings, the RCMP in Ontario and Quebec and probably a lot of other provinces, they're not even working organized crime anymore because the public has got this fear that this terrorism stuff is happening all over. So they're doing surveillance on everybody that may have ever met an Arab person, and it's really sad. I mean, once again, not a criticism of the RCMP, but the social media and media worlds created this thing that they have to respond to now. And so everything else gets pushed aside because they just don't have enough bodies to do it all. I'm sure CSIS is under incredible pressure,
Well, and when push comes to shove, Chris, I mean, when you look at, you mentioned organized crime, for example, if you were to measure the impact on Canadian society and the threat to public safety and the threat to our existence as a nation, organized crime is orders of magnitude more important than terrorism. You know, I mean, I just wrote a whole book on, you know, terrorism and Canada's Confederation. It's a blip on the radar. At best, and I'm not saying don't investigate it. My God, I spent 15 years investigating it myself. But we've got our priorities, you know, sort of backwards in that we're saying because of the social media, political pressure, you know, terrorism. Well, actually, it's pretty rare in Canada. Whereas organized crime and other types of things, domestic assault, domestic abuse,
fentanyl,
drugs. Yeah, exactly. Those are national priorities, yeah. Not the fact that once every 15 years we get a terrorist attack in this country.
For sure. You know, it's good to hear you say it because you know that business better than I do. But when you look at organized crime murders, when you look at just mental health instances, Manassian, you know, the guy in Nova Scotia, I didn't want to say his name. I mean, look at the death and destruction just in those cases, not organized crime, but bombs going off, cars blowing up, restaurants blowing up because of an illegal gaming war in the GTA. Exactly. You know, those are huge impacts on public safety. And you know, remember the kid got killed years ago in a biker war in Montreal because he was kind of close to a car that blew up. And so where's the public outcry and the focus on resources and to investigate those things? When in reality, you've got all kinds of surveillance teams out there following people around that might have known a terrorist once.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. I'm hoping that, you know, somebody's listening to you and I talk today about this. But so it sounds to me, Chris, like real retirement isn't anywhere in your immediate future. So are more Canadians expecting to see you regularly on national television to talk about these kinds of issues? Or are you finally going to toss in your badge one day, pick up a beer at the cottage, and that'll be the last we see of Chris Lewis?
Well, I think our collectively, our relevance has an expiration date, you know?
Yeah,
and I used to lecture a lot in interrogation, and then I realized I haven't interrogated anybody for 4 or 5 years. And someone said to me in the audience, when's the last time you got a murder confession? I have to say, I don't know, 6 years ago. So, you know, the time comes. And so I wonder about my shelf life. On certain issues, some issues will never change, but you know, the new faces will appear. The Phil Gerseys and the Chris Lewises that are out working the streets now will someday be having our roles. So, in the meantime, I'm writing another book, and it's coincidentally called "I Only Wanted to Be a Detective."
I love
it. And it's really about just a kid from Sault Ste. Marie joining the OPP and all the things I saw over those years. Not necessarily things I did or that I solved a murder or I arrested a bad guy, but just the big events I was involved in just as a bit player, whether it be SARS coming to Canada or it be 9/11 or it be, you know, the new millennium rollover and also Pope's visits, etc. Just kind of a chronology history in the OPP over my 36 years. But it's not a, hey, look at me, I solved a murder type of story at all. Because I did solve a couple, but not very many.
Well, it certainly sounds to me, Chris, that when the new book comes out, we'll have to have you on back on the podcast to talk about your career per se. And listen, kudos to you for what you do, with Bell Media and CTV. Kudos for being a voice of reason as somebody who actually, you know, as I like to use the phrase, works the coal face for many, many. I'm not saying this because you're from the Sioux and up in Cap. Yeah. I don't want to use too many mining analogies here, but clearly you've got a credibility I think that many don't in this particular area. So listen, thanks so much for sharing your views with my listeners, and take care of there on the left coast out in Victoria.
Thank you, Phil, and all the best to you as well. When I see your face on TV, I always feel better because I know we're going to get something that makes sense, and that means a lot to all Canadians, I believe, and I'm not a politician, so I'm not saying that for that reason. So, all the best to you.
So that was my conversation with Chris Lewis. What'd you think about our conversation? You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com, or on Twitter, borealissaves. You can find me also on LinkedIn and on Facebook. If you like this, want to subscribe, go to the website, borealisthreatandrisk.com, hit the subscribe button. You can get all this content free of charge. You'll also find a link there for my new book, The History of Terrorism in Canada, the Federation of the Present, the Peaceable Kingdom. Love to hear from you. I'll talk to you again soon. Until then, stay safe.